Welcome to Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle, coming up on the programme this week.
Do you feel suicidal? Before I ever asked that, yeah, it was terror. I will actually say that it's a very scary thought.
Loneliness, again, is one of those things which, even when we started doing the podcast in 2017, loneliness wasn't really living within the mental health world. Loneliness was something which was separate.
Yeah, loneliness is significantly associated with later suicidal ideation and behaviour. It's not just a small window. It's anything up to 5 years later.
And I'll be reminding you how you can make connections with mental health organisations within your community. It's Mental Health Monday.
Yeah, the home of the UK's conversation about mental health. Welcome to Mental Health Monday. I've not mentioned it recently, so I'll just give another plug to the Mental Health Monday Facebook group, which you can now join. Just look for the Mental Health Monday logo on that one. I'm also up and about on Facebook. You can catch me too on Twitter and Instagram. That's at Mr. Mick Coyle. That's at Mr. Mick Coyle. Now, on my, I think it's my Twitter, I've got a link to my email address. If you're interested in putting forward a guest for the show, recommending someone to speak to, absolutely keen to hear from plenty of people who've got an insight into the world of mental health. That's what the platform is for here at Mental Health Monday. Do drop me an email. Very keen to hear from you and looking forward to sharing some more stories in the future. Going to speak to someone this week who has a great deal of knowledge and passion when it comes to the issue of suicide. Now, Heather McClelland is our guest. She is a doctoral student, soon to be doctor, and a research assistant at the University of Glasgow. She's done a great deal of work looking at factors that might lead to suicide, maybe some of the common themes, pulling together wider research and data that can offer us a real insight into what might take someone down a path where they start to consider suicide. And then, of course, what we can do to change that path and to try and bring down some of the numbers. Just in Scotland in the last year, more than 750 people died by suicide, according to the 2021 figures that came out last week, seen by Mental Health Monday. So this is high stakes, absolutely high stakes. Two people there in Scotland every single day. And we've got to do something about it. We've got to get it right. We've got to change the conversation, and we've got to get the conversation right as well. How can we do that? And also, how can we use this research to really bring this to life and to start saving lives? So there's loads in this conversation. It's a lengthy one as well, and I really enjoyed it as well with Heather. There's some links at the end of the podcast which get a mention. I'll put a digital link to them in the notes to the podcast where you can find out some more information. Congratulations to Heather, by the way, who is about to secure, hopefully, her doctorate, and then she will be Dr. Heather. She certainly will be next time she appears on the podcast. Started off by talking about why she was so passionate about this subject.
Definitely, I've always been interested in interpersonal factors and how they can have a role in mental well-being and just how it can impact on mood. How I came into suicide research and self-harm was actually, again, my interest in psychology. I became an assistant psychologist. So I was a clinician sitting in front of young people and children, and especially with teenagers, the difference in their presentations. There'd be some people who'd be saying that they're experiencing suicidal ideation and self-harm thoughts because of the distress that they're experiencing, that they couldn't take the pain anymore, and they wanted it to stop. They wanted a way out. They felt trapped. And then there would be, I could have the next patient, you know, an hour later, who would present completely differently, but still say the same things. I want to get out. I want to leave, because I have no connection. I don't feel anything. And I think that was the thing that really led me down this kind of route, where it was just, yeah, just that kind of difference, the complexity that comes with self-harm and suicide, where you can see it come, you can see the distress someone's in, and for the next person, you just didn't see it, coming. And speaking to people's lived experience, that is something that is quite stressful for them to share, is that they just didn't see the warning signs. And so really, I think it was that kind of motivation that I wanted to get to know it a little bit better, and the interpersonal factors that are associated with it that can help protect someone from these thoughts and these behaviors, and also for on the other side of that coin, factors in, you know, past and present that can actually feed into these decisions that people just, you know, they just don't want to go on. So I think, and also I think with anyone who's, you know, when you get to know something, you get to know it, when you become better at it, you become more invested, and you see these nuanced gaps and these complexities that where you actually, you see these differences of the person sitting in front of you that don't apply to others. So I think it is just that it's so different from person to person, and understanding how we can make sense of that to develop into strategies to help the masses. So quite a long-winded answer there, but it is just the differences that, as you were saying a little just before this interview, about how people have got so many different suggestions on how to resolve it, and it's just because one size does not fit all. It's a tricky situation.
No, absolutely. It's a very good answer, by the way. And I guess it's why sort of research and sort of the academic side of this and things like data is quite important. Because I think as a society, and maybe members of the public like myself, our understanding of suicide is based on either our own personal experience of people that we know or hearing stories of why somebody did. And of course, we now know that so many of those stories aren't true. We don't know often what people are going through. But of course, when you have access to, obviously, patient records, the actual patients themselves, the clients that you might be dealing with, I guess you get to then be able to track and see trends, spot those signs of going, well, those two people had the same potential outcome or the same suicide ideation. But of course, it came from a million and one different places. But I guess what I'm saying is that the academic and the research side of things allows us to work out what are those, where are the crossovers on the Venn diagrams, and where can we obviously then put our focus on?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's nothing will ever compensate for sitting or speaking to a therapist or someone where you can actually sit down and have that formulation and see where that person's come from, what their experiences earlier in life have led for them to have these coping tools or behaviours or current situation. There's nothing that can really compensate for that kind of personalised approach. But definitely having research that is quantitative, so, you know, working with numbers and things and being able to see the statistics of this intervention makes a significant difference to the masses. So this is something that we should pursue. That is really helpful, especially for policymakers, for getting for, you know, government officials, for getting that message out there. This is something that we can really help with the masses, but also you can't really go down the quantitative route, which, in my opinion, without first going down the qualitative route as well. You need to go, and this is something that I've learned recently because I'm coming to the end of my doctorate, is that speaking to the experts, speaking to the people that lived experience and getting to know their experiences, and then seeing from that, where should I pursue the data? Where should I pursue the quantitative things to then take to the politicians so they can enact a strategy on a national level? I think that's, yeah, there's definitely three prongs to it. The formulation for the personalized, person-centered approach, the qualitative to know where to start looking for these differences, and the quantitative data to be able to back it up in order to put these strategies and these proposals into place. It's all so important, definitely.
Can I ask you about sort of any preconceptions maybe that you had? We've all grown up in a world where we've sort of heard about suicide and phrases that you hear around suicide, which now I won't even repeat them, but they sound like they're from the 1950s. They're outdated. And yet if it happened tomorrow in our communities, you would hear the same sorts of things being said. But naturally, I think we have our own thoughts around what you're expecting to hear. Was there anything in particular that you had preconceptions about that you were proved wrong, or were there things around it where you thought, oh, actually, no, there is, I'm right here, or this does fit in with, you know, the expertise that I've developed through, you know, the psychological training that you've been doing?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple, and I hold my hands up to saying that I've definitely been stood corrected about it. I think the first one, which I imagine anyone who has kind of been confronted with having to, or feeling like need to ask that question, do you feel suicidal? Before I ever asked that, yeah, it was terror. I will actually say that it's a very scary thought. And because you worry about their answer, you worry about the consequences of you asking that question. I think back at it, just blind terror without even knowing what what would be on the other side of that at all. But obviously with, as I say, being a former clinician and now in the research field of it, it is a question that I ask on a regular basis. And also I have experience of asking it 2 times in my personal life as well. And I have to say 100% of the time, I've never had a bad response to it. It's always been either relief of someone, like, and you can always see it. I can see it clinically. It's someone that I've asked, are you having thoughts of harming yourself? And you can see that in their eyes sometimes that they're like, I feel seen, I feel noticed. And there's no harm in asking that. There is data to suggest that indicates that people almost feel like a catharsis of having the opportunity to discuss it, and that there is a stigma around not wanting to talk about it because of the implications of it. So yeah, that's probably the first preconception that I've been corrected about it, is that it's never been poorly. There's what in my personal life when I asked it, it was met with laughter, and they were like, no, I'm fine, I'm great and everything. But at least I was able to communicate with them that I'm noticing them. I see that they're struggling. This is something that I'm open to talking to them about, and that they can actually discuss it openly. And I think you communicate a lot more just by asking that question than just, you know, I'm worried about you. It is also that I'm here for you and things. So that would be the first.
On that, Heather, can I just on that? I think it's really interesting on the issue of that phrase, are you feeling suicidal? I think it flies against everything we've grown up being told or told to think about suicide. Don't mention it, don't talk about it, don't ask anyone about it. But actually the evidence is actually the opposite. The evidence is ask that question. It gives you a much more positive outcome than not asking the question. And that's a leap we've got to make, hasn't it, in terms of the way we talk about society talks about people who are experiencing really difficult times when it comes to their mental health.
Yeah, definitely. If you look at going down the academic route, if you start looking at models of suicidal behavior, going back to what we're saying about trying to make sense of people's experiences, more often than not, they do mention about social support. Do you have the social support there to help you with your mood? And even in safety plans that, you know, are used regularly clinically, they're quite often socially support based. Do you have someone who can give you, you can be distracted by, like, not necessarily talking about your thoughts and things, but like someone that you can go play football with, someone that you can go for a walk with, have a cup of tea. And then is there someone that you can speak to more personally and say, look, I am struggling here. So yeah, definitely having that shift of actually getting, I think we're approaching that hump, I feel, that we're recognizing that stigma is perpetuating it. And everyone, I feel like most people are saying, yeah, you can talk to me, but we've yet to get to that level of confidence of actually acting on it. And I think a lot of that is to do with wanting to not be a burden, not wanting to not cause distress, and not like wanting to let people down. It's really common for people who, you know, they want to seem that they're coping, that they're managing, that they actually put that pressure on themselves of, I can't talk to people because otherwise I'll let my parents down, I'll let my friends down, my partner down. And it is actually just getting to having that bravery, and it is a scary thing, to saying, no, I'm struggling here and I need you to hear me, and we need to do something about this. Yeah, and I think that anyone who can actually say that is a very brave person who's clearly communicating that they're wanting to fight. It's not that they're giving up, that they're actually using all the means they can to get that help.
Absolutely. That was very profound, that, Heather. I'm now going to ask you for your second preconception now, which might... I don't want to embarrass you around these things, and we seem to be focusing a lot on them, but I think it's so interesting, and it just feeds into that wider conversation, our wider understanding of what mental health is. So give us that one. We won't give you a hard time on it, because we've all got preconceptions. Of course we have.
Yeah. It's such a huge subject, suicide. And yeah, like I say, the more you talk about it, you just go down this rabbit warren. The other one, I think, and I have already touched on it again, it's just the variety of presentations, not to use clinical speak about it, but again, like going back to my examples, you can see I used to think that you would be able to see suicide, that you'd be able to see the distress, that you can see that if you think about depression, you know, like being exhausted all the time, being tearful and things like that. But with suicide, that's not necessarily the case. It can be people just walking around and just, you know, still laughing at people's jokes, still going to work, and then all of a sudden you hear that they're in hospital, or even worse, that there's been a fatality and they've died. And it is just that you can be caught so off guard. There was a study, it's getting on a bit, I can't remember who wrote it, but it was that CEOs, you know, high achievers, who they want to be everything to everybody, they're putting that pressure, and they hit that peak of this me hitting the best I can for perfectionism, or being perfectionistic, or being perfect, sorry. And then it's the pressure of, well, I don't want to topple down from that. Again, going back to that failure of I can't be anything less than what I am now, and the stress is just getting to me. And then they crack, and they think the only way out for them is to you know, injure themselves, to die by suicide. So yeah, it is that kind of, you can't assume that people are, just because you look upset doesn't mean you're not fighting. And also, just because you look fine doesn't mean that you are. So it is just, again, that goes back to that question of, it's so vital, if you get any kind of inclination that someone might be having a plan, thinking about hurting themselves, it's so important to ask them, and also to be receptive to when someone may choose you to disclose that information, to take it seriously and act upon it, and, you know, thank them for their bravery. So yeah, I think those are the two preconceptions. There are others, but those are the two, I think, that are the biggest ones that I've learned from.
I think that's really interesting, and that idea around, you know, you can't see it. And then, of course, for many people, the moment where it's something that they are aware of, by that point, it might already be too late. And then, of course, it leaves behind, doesn't it, this legacy of, I should have known, I should have spotted the signs, leaves people with really difficult sort of questions in their own mind around why they didn't spot it. And yet here we've got, you know, an academic researcher and yourself saying, well, it's not, you know, it's not something which shows a face. And of course, you know, people will say, oh, I should have spotted the clues, I should have seen the signs. But then, you know, I've heard parents say, but if I had seen the signs, if there were signs, I would have seen them and I would have done something about it. And I just wondered whether or not the sort of the hangovers around the stigma around suicide and the taboos and the myths and all that kind of stuff, I just wonder how much of a part that still plays in this world of don't show you're struggling, don't let on that you've in any other world, if you woke up one morning and thought, I'm thinking of taking my own life, you'd go, oh, goodness me, that's a really dreadful thought. There must be something wrong. I'll go and speak to someone about it. Yet there is this other thing that's going around. And I wonder if it comes from this almost institutionalized nature of, well, suicide is about weakness, or it's about failure, or it's about all these other things. Does that still muddy the water in what might otherwise be a more open conversation?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. It absolutely is. I was doing I could not do an interview last year, and it was with participants who had experiences of suicide attempt, to learn about the interpersonal factors again that led to their wanting to die by suicide, and stigma came straight out of there. And it was to do with mental health, that they might lose their friends, like that their friends would treat them differently. And also how mental health services, how they would respond about their concern for losing autonomy and things that, so the stigma everywhere. And I think that definitely when it comes to intergenerational values, they take a long time to be diluted down and to be altered, because I think most people want to do their parents proud, and they like, and you know, adhere to their values, or to be sensitive to the older generations and things. But I can see it, you know, when I see my extended family and see how they communicate about mental health and things, you can see that this transition it's going in a positive direction, I think, but there's definitely a long way to go. And also again, like when I'm around socially, you know, going to like the pub, for example, and you can hear people chatting away, there can be that almost perpetuation of stigmatizing language. And sometimes it can just be talk, and it can just be like people having a laugh. There was actually it was a few months ago, and I was out with some friends, and there was actually a table next to me, a group of, I don't know, eight folk, and they were just using the most outdated and stigmatizing language ever. And I did actually sit there going, so there's eight people there, one of them statistically, ever the statistician, one of them will have likely experienced some form of mental health in their past or in their future, and their friends around them are saying this kind of language. Well, I thought, my personal opinion was that that was almost building up a wall of, okay, that person will maybe not feel comfortable enough to talk to these friends because this is what they seemingly think. So we need to almost change the language and be a little bit more considerate of, even if someone's not in trouble now, we need to think about the message we're conveying and the language that we use so that we are removing any barriers to someone help seeking in the future. Again, going back to that, do you feel suicidal? Because even if they say no, at least they know the door is open, that that is to maybe someone they can talk to that will be receptive to it. And it, so with mental health as well, saying, you know, using language like that's crazy, that's mental type thing, it might be quite off the cuff for most people, but also thinking about what impact that can have with someone who does feel like they're actually struggling with mental health, it can cause some barriers there. So yeah, there's progress being made, but there's also a way to go, which I guess is forever the party line, really, isn't it?
I was in the pub once, and there was a guy trying to tell his mates that the only known cure for depression was cannabis use. And I had to go, I appreciate, you know, that you might be having this conversation for a reason, but I'm not entirely sure that that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a couple of websites you might want to go to that might be able to actually find the information you are looking for. Yeah. This guy was, he went, oh, no, you're right, mate. Yeah, no, that's a good point you've made there. And but it was one of them, I just thought, if they go away thinking, oh, right, well, I'll start smoking this, that, and the other, I thought... But it was one I'm, but he was almost like holding court with like this information, mm-hmm. and research that he'd done, and I just thought no. Luckily they were, well, he was quite mellow for reasons which you know, maybe self-explanatory, mm-hmm. but yeah, when I mentioned that, but you do hear those conversations all the time, don't you? You do hear those, that sort of language that's being used, and you just sometimes I auto correct it, if you like,
yeah,
and mm-hmm. other times, I think this is maybe a conversation around sort of the language, which other times I let language go, because sometimes I don't want someone to say, well, maybe I'm talking about mental health for the first time, and I accidentally use the phrase commit suicide. I don't want to then go and go, you can't say that, because they'll go, oh, I thought I couldn't say that, and I shouldn't have mentioned it. I should never have mentioned suicidal thoughts or whatever. Whereas you almost don't want to, you almost have to say, look, let's come in, let's all make our mistakes. Let's say all the wrong things, but let's do it in a public way, so we're not feeling like we're being held back. But as long as it does have that sort of guiding hand around it that says, actually, you might want to use this language instead, or maybe this, you use the phrase, you know, die by suicide before, which I think, you know, is the phrase that I'm hearing more and more often as being the positive thing. When we talk about sort of circumstances as well, I know you've written about the word loneliness. Loneliness, mm-hmm. again, is one of those things which, even when we started doing the podcast in 2017, loneliness wasn't really living within the mental health world. Loneliness was something which was separate. And as we've sort of progressed and our understanding has become more, when we've talked about people's sense of belonging, people's sense of being part of something, people's sense of either social isolation or sort of personal isolation, that word loneliness has really come to the fore, mm-hmm. in terms of feeling lonely, not being alone. Loneliness and being alone, completely different things. But I know that loneliness came a lot up in your research. I think this is a really fascinating thing when we look at maybe a social response to the mental health crisis that we're facing as a country and the suicidal crisis that we're facing as a country. If we could deal with loneliness, we might be getting somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, definitely. It's such a big subject, and you're absolutely right. It just seemed to have just erupted over the last few years. I think the trigger of it, although it has always been, it's been bubbling away for a while, but it was the there was a systematic review that found that loneliness was associated with 2.5 times more likely experiencing cardiac disease. And so it's showing that link between mental health and physical health. And there is research to find that loneliness is associated with later depression, but there hadn't been any research, systematic review research, where we compile all the smaller studies together to say, okay, what are we actually dealing with here? That's what I mean by research here. To look at, well, just, okay, so it impacts on physical health in terms of like your cardiovascular, it impacts on your later mood and things, but just to what extent does it actually impact in terms of self-harm? And in this systematic review, and I also did a meta-analysis to back up the data with numbers, and it was found that, yeah, loneliness is significantly associated with later suicidal ideation and behaviour. And it's not just a small window, it's anything up to 5 years later. So it does have a huge impact on not only your physical well-being, but also your mental well-being. And I'm just trying, like, there's so much going on there, because loneliness, as you say, like, you don't need to be by yourself to feel lonely. You can be lonely in the crowd, but also you can be connected to friends and still be romantically lonely, or, you know, family-wise lonely, like your parents, your siblings, etc. And there was another form of loneliness that I came across an article. It was only last month. Cultural loneliness as well. So you can have, you know, say come to the UK, like, not to, obviously there's a lot of things going on at the minute, but, like, you know, come to the UK, got your family, developing friends, but you've got that cultural separation. So the mannerisms that you're surrounded by may be incongruent to your own. And these are all things that can independently be associated with later suicidality. And that's one thing, that these are all individual things that are really difficult to overcome. So it is a very tricky thing to be able to address.
And I guess as well, you know, loneliness by definition, you know, is your leg broken? Yes, your leg is broken. Are you lonely? Well, you know, it's not the sort of thing that presents itself in a way which is absolutely, even I imagine for the person experiencing it. There was a statue that came out the other week from the ONS that was like a huge sort of state of the nation report, and it was something like 45% of the population, only 45% of, felt that their life had a sense of meaning.
Yeah,
which was like a really low, and that I found a depressing number, that people felt like they existed in a world which didn't really notice them. Mm-hmm. Or in a world where if they dropped the pebble, there was no ripple. And I thought that feeds into that sense of loneliness, because it feeds into that conversation of, what role do I have here? If I wasn't here, what would anyone notice? And actually, even to read a stat like that, which was so high that so many people feel, well, actually, you know, I don't really feel like my life has that much meaning to it. Like, mm-hmm. there's the day-to-day, which might have the day-to-day meaning. But if you were asked to sort of step back and assess, you might think negatively about yourself. I thought that really struck me as like a not a good place to be just in society, because it spoke of a place where you wouldn't speak to your neighbours, or your neighbours wouldn't realise if you'd gone on holiday for 2 weeks, and they wouldn't let on and say, did you have a nice break when you came back? Or a boss who didn't really care if you'd sent that email or not. Yeah. You know, that's that much more wider conversation around sort of well-being in society. That feeds into then these more specific cases that we're talking about.
Definitely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's Durkheim back in like the 1970s said that an integral element of life is being connected to something that is beyond ourselves, that transitions our own existence. And you can see it, there's interventions for tackling loneliness, which is helping people to reconnect with hobbies, to whether, like, you know, say you were, to bring a football example again, say you used to play football when you were younger, but now you've reached an age where maybe, you know, your body doesn't allow you to be able to kick a football around anymore, doesn't mean that maybe you can't still go to a local football match and then get the community feel surrounded by the supporters, the camaraderie of supporting a team, even though you don't know the name of the person next to you, type thing. So it is, yeah, someone bearing witness to you, and for you to be part of something is so important to mental health and well-being. In one of the studies that I'm pushing to get published in the next couple of months, we looked into those different forms of loneliness, and it was found that romantic loneliness, there's evidence to suggest that romantic loneliness may actually be the most pernicious of all forms of that loneliness. And it may well be because that's the person that you come home to at the end of the day. That's the person that is aware of how your job's going, how your friendships are going and things. Whereas if you think about other elements of your life, like you say, you go to work, you didn't send that email, your boss didn't notice, but then you go home and your home's empty, kind of thing. That profound kind of, as you say, that pebble that leaves no ripples type thing, that can really, that the emotional weight of that can be profound and can actually become unbearable. So and you know, again, leading to depression, low mood, feeling trapped, you can really see where this narrative can go to as people engaging in these kind of behaviors.
And I guess in terms of sort of, you know, behaviors, or, you know, where the research can take us, where this knowledge can take us in terms of how do we do that, you know, you can be, you know, we look at the age at which, you know, men in particular are taking those, like, their lives, you know, this mm-hmm. sort of like 40s and 50s period, where mm-hmm. I guess they've lived their life up to a point where they suddenly go, oh, I'm looking at, now's the point I look around and I can't see better option than this pathway that I'm finding myself on. But I'm guessing in terms of the research and the knowledge, we've got to think about how does that feedback from 10 years before that or 20 years before that, or that sense of the community around a person that they go, okay, my marriage is broken down, or all the kids have left home, or I've lost my job, but I do have this group, or I still have this passion for gardening is the big one for me at the moment, or like I do have this other like group or community that I'm part of. So I'm not suddenly now isolated on my own and the pebble with, you know, with no ripple. I'm actually a person. I have values in and of myself, but they're also recognized in this group or that group or this piece of art that I was involved in or this poem that I once wrote or any of those things. Yeah. And I wonder whether or not that's where we talk about long-term strategies. It's hard to kind of legislate for, because you can't necessarily get an instant result on it. Yet a world where everybody was empowered with all that knowledge and that sense of community, and we placed value and invested in it, we might reach better periods for people like the bloke at the age of 45 who decides that that's the best option for him to take his own life.
Yeah. And I think that goes back to a lot of what we've already covered, you know, thinking about stigma, as you say, you know, 30 years ago or whatever, if you're divorced in your mid-40s, that would be a lot more of a sordid issue than what it is now. So again, that intergenerational, that gradual transition that we are making our way further forward. There was a podcast that you led. I'm not going to do a name justice. Was it Lisa Leadbeater on loneliness?
Yes.
Yeah, so, and she made
Kim Ledbetter, the MP who was working with, I think it was the Red Cross. The fact the Red Cross run like a loneliness helpline in the UK tells you how much, you know, how serious you need to take the issue. But sorry, go on, yeah.
Oh, no, just that she made a really good point that we've gone on to the point where out of our work commitments, we don't have hobbies anymore. We have extra jobs, we have extra side hustles, and given like the state of probably globally the financial state, that's quite understandable. But we're not doing that, those hobbies where we're doing it for ourselves, where we're doing it for our own self-care, and again trying, like, connecting to something that is beyond ourselves just for the pure enjoyment of it. So it is good to be able to compartmentalize, as you were saying about, well, this thing's not going well, but I do have my friends, or I do have my kids, or whatever. It's good to be able to compartmentalize the negative, but also to use those coping tools to, like, reframe and accentuate the positive. And that's something that it would, I think that would be really helpful for future strategies to go down. There's a researcher in Norway called Weiss, and he's a huge leader on loneliness, and he's just published research on the happiness route, where he's helping facilitate people to reconnect with the hobbies, to remove those boundaries, a bit like what we're talking about with communicating about suicidality, removing those boundaries so that people can go back to the hobbies that they did when they were younger in whatever way, shape or form, or to be able to pursue the passions that they're experiencing now, whether that is poetry or gardening or joining like a gardening club. Like there's the men's sheds across the UK, which are absolutely fantastic. And again, it's people doing something that they enjoy in the company of others and just letting those friendships develop naturally, as opposed to, you know, almost like speed dating where you chuck everyone together, make small talk. It's not that, it needs to be a lot more organic than that. So I think, in my opinion, I'd say the future is hopefully facilitating more community networks, you know, on a smaller scale, so you've got the opportunity to be able to bump into the same faces again. And as you like, you know, the amount of our friends who have a lockdown, they got a dog and now they've never felt so popular in their lives, because now they've got people talking to them and like talking to the dog and recognizing the dog, and they feel a lot more integrated in the community, even though they've lived there for years. So you're having those kind of strategies, I think, those not financially motivated but just sheer enjoyment motivated, would do a lot for loneliness, connectivity, and hopefully suicidality is the hope. So
mine are gardening, playing the ukulele, and jigsawing. Everyone knows jigsawing. Forget it. It beats Instagram for your dopamine hits. Jigsawing. What are yours? I've got to ask you what yours are.
Lockdown, I think I must have spent a small fortune on jigsaws. Absolutely.
1,000 piece minimum.
So fun.
Were they 1,000 piece minimum? I'm not having none of this 500 piece nonsense.
It's getting to the point where like I'm not quite ready for one of those single colour ones when you only look at the shapes though. Like that's just a different kind of, that's a jigsaw. No. Definitely into my jigsawing, especially when it's raining up here in Glasgow. But I also am getting better at carving out time for running. And that's the one that even if I don't get as far as I want, as long as I enjoyed it, or, you know, it just so happened that my iPod shuffle came on at like the right playlist, picked at random. So those are definitely the things that I do for my own self-esteem. And, you know, I do it by myself, but I do still feel part of a community because I follow running groups on Instagram and Twitter and things. So I still do feel, even though I'm an independent runner, I can still relate to the posts that pop up on these websites.
Oh, absolutely. No one else, apart from my kids and my wife, will ever hear me play the ukulele. But it does feel like it feels like a community thing. Just very quickly, Heather, before we go, there's sort of a consultation in Scotland at the moment. You're based at the University of Glasgow, where people can sort of get involved. I'll put the link actually in the notes if people listen to this on the day that it's launching, but closing towards the end of October 2022. Mm-hmm. And people can have their say, can't they? If they think, you know what, I think there are things that can be done from a mental health point of view, because there are consultations on this and these sort of opinions are being sought at the moment.
Yeah, it's the Suicide Prevention Action Group and the Suicide Prevention Action Plan. And it's being led by the NSPLG, which I should be able to remember a lot faster than that since I've worked there for so long. So we're developing the new action plan for Scotland, and literally everyone is qualified to voice an opinion on this, whether you've got experience firsthand of suicidal ideation, self-harm, or you've got lived experience through others, or if you've not got any experience at all, what would you want to look for, or what would you want to be aware of in terms of channels to be able to keep yourself or someone else safe that actually express these thoughts to you. So it's very much open to the public and for their input, and we do take it very seriously. I had a meeting this morning and we were discussing the feedback. So if anyone's got an opinion, we will be reading it and we will be taking it on board.
And that sort of reflects this sort of new world that we're in, where, you know, people want to know, because it's not just about sort of that the medical side of things. It's how people feel, how people have interacted with, you know, these sorts of thoughts or feelings, or people who've been experiencing these sorts of feelings. And when you start to consider it, there's mental health in absolutely everything, isn't there?
Oh yeah, absolutely. The use of a lived experience panel has been integral to the National Suicide Prevention Leadership Group. That's what the NSL and oh, so close. I nearly had it. NSPLG. There we go. But yeah, lived experience panels are becoming more and more popular in mental health networks, and also with the agenda that we're developing. And again, it is just going back to these experts, and also the feedback that we get from these lived experience panels is the sense of community that they get, that and the support that they are given. That is, we make sure that, I say we, it's an external panel, but the people who run it that we collaborate with, they always make sure that they are that everyone who's involved is involved to the extent that they want to be. They're never asked to do anything more than what they're willing to do. They're welcome to step back whenever they want, and just it's a very comforting and supportive place, is from what I've seen. And yeah, again, it gives that sense of membership, and also that everyone's experiences are valid, even if you've got an experience or a viewpoint that is different to everyone else's. Great, still that brings variety in things. I definitely articulate it, and yeah, they've been a wealth of knowledge. They've helped us develop a website based in Scotland specifically for the Scottish population, but obviously it's worldwide, so everyone's welcome to check it out. And it's called Surviving Suicidal Thoughts, and it's peer-led from the lived experience panel, but it's got input. It's a multidisciplinary approach because we've got clinicians, academics like myself, and the lived experience panel involved in it. So this multifaceted way of tackling mental health, I definitely think, is the why haven't we been doing this sooner? Is
Absolutely,
why did it take
absolutely.
so long?
Heather, thank you so much for your time today. We'll put all those links in the notes of the podcast, and thanks for speaking to us on Mental Health Monday.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Thanks for checking out Mental Health Monday. My name is Mick Coyle. You can find me on Twitter at Mr. Mick Coyle. You can also find me, Mick Coyle, on Facebook as well. Don't forget, if you want to speak to somebody about your mental health, you can do so. The Samaritans, free to call on 116 123. You can find mental health services where you are. Just look for the Hub of Hope. Type in your postcode. It'll find those mental health services close to you. And for support in a crisis, you can text SHOUT to 85258. That's if you're experiencing a personal crisis, you're unable to cope and need support. Shout to 85258. That's a text line. Do get involved in those services. In an absolute emergency, always remember the number to call is 999. Thanks for downloading the podcast this week. We'll be back next week with more Mental Health Monday.